Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Bob and Yart Live. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church, Hollywood hero, cultural hero, Hillary hero. Harvey Weinstein's sexual assault trial begins today in New York City. We'll cover that as the weeks go on. But today, we need to discuss Iran's terrorist leader, Qasem Soleimani, being killed for what we're about to discuss. It will take the brightest audience in the country to follow these vital observations. So put on your thinking cap. If you're driving, pull over. No, I'm only kidding. You got to think about what I'm about to say. Psychoanalyzing the Americans who are angry about the killing of another Islamic terror leader. We reach a diagnosis of a disease that afflicts not only them, but also most of those who disagree with them. Now think about this. It turns out that these intense differences of opinion, disagreements, 180-degree differences of opinion on most of the major issues in the headlines today. Of course, these disagreements are not the cause of the disease that we have diagnosed, but they're a symptom. These incessant, nationwide disagreements nowadays on almost every government action, true or false, on almost every government policy announced, extreme, intense disagreements, widespread, are a symptom of a disease which is almost universally ignored. Now, if you think it's Trump derangement syndrome, it's not. This disease predates Trump derangement syndrome, and that actually is just a symptom of this much deeper disease. Its name is never uttered, at least not in the context of a malady. Its name is only uttered in the context of some kind of a denial, a refusal to even consider this malady as a disease. What you find instead, you find rare agreement between Republicans and Democrats about this disease, about the denial. Religious people and atheists, liberals and conservatives, the rare agreement between all these sides has to do with their denial, their refusal to recognize this widespread public health hazard. I'm talking about a mental health hazard, but also it affects your health in other ways. Now, what is it? What disease am I talking about? It's the disease that turns half a nation against the other half. It's called democracy. How many more examples do we need before at least Christian conservatives will begin to recognize that democracy itself, going to the polls to elect leaders, is a dysfunction? It's a dysfunction in human society. How many more examples will we need? I mean, for half of a nation to not even be able to agree that killing a terrorist leader, one of the world's top terrorists, is a good thing, for them not to be able to see that. Beginning next week, we are going to go through line by line a proposed constitution for America, completely different from the one that we have now. Hardly a similarity. After all, the conservative talking heads who get so upset when they say, so-and-so, look what they're doing. It's unconstitutional. Have you ever heard that? Look what they're doing. Look at Altez. Look at what Hillary, look what Bernie wants. Look what, it's unconstitutional what they're proposing. They get so upset about something they say is unconstitutional, but they seem to share another symptom. It's their lack of concern regarding the Constitution itself being unconstitutional. Now, is that possible? Is it, I mean, even theoretically, is it theoretically possible for a constitution to be unconstitutional? Well, it is. And I will explain how. But not right now. We've done this occasionally over the years, on the air occasionally, off the air more frequently. And you could show as clear as could be that the U.S. Constitution is unconstitutional. It's invalid on its face. Now, I know some people who think logically are thinking, well, that's not possible. A constitution can't be unconstitutional. But of course, a statement could be self-contradictory, right? And I'm not saying that the U.S. Constitution is self-contradictory. I'm saying that it's unconstitutional. So I know there are plenty of people out there. I said you have to think, really got to put on your thinking caps, pull your car over, and you really got to think through the things that we're discussing today. And in a way, I'm making it a bit unfair because it's not until next week that I will discuss how it is that the U.S. Constitution is completely unconstitutional. But let's say, just for argument's sake, if you could just cut me enough slack to presume that when I've talked about this over the last 30 years with dozens of conservatives, more often than not, they've looked at it and they've said, well, yeah, that's a good point. And they see that the Constitution is unconstitutional. But then let me tell you what happens next. What happens next in the people who see, who become convinced that the Constitution is unconstitutional, what would you guess would happen next in their minds? If you guessed nothing, you've guessed correctly. Because it's completely irrelevant. It means nothing. It means absolutely nothing. So think about this. Those who spend their entire careers publicly advocating that everyone must abide by the Constitution. And if it turns out that they are completely uninterested in seeing whether the Constitution itself is somehow inherently invalid, or even those who look at it and say, hey, you know, that's a good point. I guess the Constitution is unconstitutional. It turns out that they couldn't care less. It doesn't even give them pause. Whether they're watching the next talking head, whether it's Sean Hannity or whoever, condemning somebody for being unconstitutional, they're all in. And so what does that tell us? If this phenomenon among conservatives, you see it much more among conservatives than you would among progressives, leftists, liberals, Democrats. What does it tell us about this obsession with the Constitution? Well, if what I'm describing to you is correct, that many conservatives can see the evidence and even be persuaded that the U.S. Constitution is unconstitutional, and then it means absolutely nothing to them, what it tells us about their lifelong, repeated, ad nauseum commitment to the Constitution and everyone, we need, if we want to fix what's wrong with America, we have to follow the Constitution. What it tells us about them is that their commitment was never actually to the Constitution. It never was. There's something else that they're committed to. And their constitutionalism is only a facade. It's a trick that they use, even with themselves. Oftentimes, we want to fool ourselves so we could continue some kind of destructive thinking or behavior. But especially, it's a trick against others to try to get as many people as possible to support a number of outcomes that they desire. In other words, they use the Constitution to try to increase their own comfort. I don't mean their physical comfort, sitting in a comfy chair with a remote control and a pillow and a throw over your knees. I don't mean that. But they want to increase their comfort with society, with the government, with the world, where things may happen that they want to see happen. So they pretend adherence to constitutionalism as a way to get more people to support the things that they want supported. Let me cover again some of what I said earlier and see if it's a bit more clear about the killing of Iran's terrorist leader Qasem Soleimani, the Quds force which he headed up. It's been designated a terrorist organization by a number of countries. You know, the Canadians, Canada, they did that back in 2012. The U.S., back when George W. Bush was still president, 2007. A couple years ago, other countries joined in, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia. Just last year in the U.S., we designated not only the Quds Force, but the entire IRGC, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, of which Quds is a part, as a terrorist organization. You know when Barack Obama condemned those who cling to their God and guns? Remember that? Their God and guns. And then Obama literally gave weapons and money to Islamic terrorists in Africa, literally. And the ISIS-supporting Islamic terrorists then used the U.S. weapons to put the ISIS flag on top of the city halls in their communities. Remember all that? I remember that. And Obama had this affinity with Iran. And talk about clinging to your God and guns. They call their army the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. I mean, how could you get more clinging to your God and guns? And Obama, he ends up giving them $150 billion. I mean, a lot of it was money from Iran that we froze when they held so many American hostages, 52 American hostages, for what, 400 and some days? So we froze some of their assets, and Obama returns so much of it in cash that Soleimani and other terrorist leaders there in Iran literally could fund their terrorist operations, funding Hezbollah in Syria, throughout the region and beyond, literally funding them with U.S. dollars, which are not even trackable because it's cash. So we killed Soleimani, which amounts to killing one of the leading terrorists in the world, right? We've killed ISIS leader al-Baghdadi recently, Osama bin Laden, al-Zarqawi. You know, only a few are infamous enough to recall their names off the top of your head. But the total number of terrorist leaders that we've killed since 9/11 is in the hundreds, many hundreds. What, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? No, no, he's not. He's not dead. He's still in Guantanamo Bay. Probably be there till he dies. So, psychoanalyzing the Americans who are angry that we killed one of the top terrorists in the world. Right? Why is it that about half of the public are angry? Well, that anger is a symptom of a disease. It, like if somebody has paranoia and they get angry for no reason at something, that anger is a symptom of their disease. It may also be an expression of their sin, of their rebellion against God, their hatred of God, and their hatred of their neighbor, and so on. So human beings are complex, but this anger, being upset at the killing of a terrorist leader, is a symptom of the disease of democracy. Democracy turns half of a nation against the other half, often in various ways. And over time, the moral capital, the spiritual capital, the financial capital that accrues to a nation, a culture, a society, because to some extent that society was following God's principles. To some extent, even an atheist, communist regime oftentimes to some extent follows God's principles. For example, you know, you could go to the Soviet Union, you could go to Red China, you could go to Cambodia, go to Cuba, where the governments themselves are murderous, but yet when there is a murder within their jurisdictions, within their countries, they will still investigate and prosecute, punish murderers. So they generally don't decriminalize murder for everyone. They want to be the ones who get to murder or say who can murder who. So in America, our government says that women could murder their children, right? Those who are pro-choice by the mother. Some are pro-choice by state, like Donald Trump has said, let the states decide. If California wants to kill kids and New York wants to kill kids, then let the states decide. That's pro-choice state by state. So there are different authorities that someone could say, I think the authority at that level over, say, the marriage, some people say that the husband should have a say in the decision. How absurd is that? Oh, yeah, the husband should have a say in whether to murder their four-year-old. You know, father's rights, or the state, or the nation. States have the responsibility to prosecute murder. They do not have the right to decriminalize murder. So one more point about President Trump before returning to society, expending the moral capital it got from Christian principles. As with George W. Bush saying, let the states decide whether or not to murder children, unborn children. Donald Trump has followed that. And also, George W. Bush's very first campaign promise, when he said, and I know we were on the air at the time, and we documented it, he said he will not ask judges whether or not they support abortion, whether or not they would tried to maintain the killing of unborn children, dismembering, chemically burning to death, and so on, the various ways to kill unborn children. He wouldn't ask that. So if somehow in Germany in the 30s and 40s, you had somehow the ability to put judges on the bench, and you said, well, I'm not going to ask these candidates whether or not they support killing Jews. So, of course, then history would condemn you as part of the wicked machine that led to the Holocaust. And so we now cheer with all the judges that Republicans put on the bench, even when we had the majority before Trump of the federal judiciary. It was radically pro-abortion, pro-homosexual, pro-leftist in so many ways. And so we'll see now. We'll see what happens after Donald Trump getting to put so many Republican judges on the bench and asking none of them if they think abortion is wrong or if they think an unborn child has a God-given right to life. Asking none of them anything about this. They just speak in code. Do you support original intent? Oh, yes, I do. Okay. So society expends the capital that was built up over time because whether it's even atheistic or not, to the extent that they worked hard, they spent less than they made, right? That's the only way to build wealth is to consume less than you produce. And the moral capital, the financial capital, even the spiritual capital that was built up over time gets expended. And you've arrived in America today at the point where we have expended so much of the moral, ethical, spiritual capital that we had benefited from because of so many people caring about what God says in different ways, that much of that is now gone. Much of it has been squandered so that democracy shows its bare teeth now. It's like nature, red in tooth and claw. That's what democracy is like. And we're seeing the results. And so democracy is the disease. Now, if you look at the question biblically, or if you look at it politically, either way, you realize that democracy is a curse. Right? Government should protect minorities from the majority. Is that true or false? Government should protect minorities from the majority. Sure, and the ultimate minority is one against the mob that might want to rob, beat up, or kill the one. So, of course, that's part of the government's job, protect minorities from the majority. You also want to protect the majority from the minority. That's true, too. But certainly government should protect minorities from the majority. So if you systematically put governmental authority in the hands of the majority, don't be surprised if you see the systematic biases of the majority being used and turned into governmental weapons against the minority. And the minority might be wealthy people or whoever, might be white men, right? For example, right now that's in vogue to be a racist, sexist, to hate white men. If you're a leftist, then you're a sexist, racist by definition because you hate white men. The Bible says that the majority is evil. Jesus said that. Matthew chapter 7. Right? Wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And then narrow is the gate and difficult is the way that leads to life, and there are few who find it. So the majority is evil, and since the majority is evil, majority rule is guaranteed over time, on balance, to be evil, so that the majority rule government over the decades, over the centuries, will take its nation into the depths of hell. The majority is evil, so once a democratic government loses the moral capital that it had inherited, then virtually nothing can restore it. You know, individuals often repent and turn toward God. The masses rarely do, and especially not of their own leading. You know, the Bible calls governing officials authorities. We still do today. And government authority does not imply majority rule, but it's rule over the majority. Democracy promotes arrogance. People say, well, you work for me. I pay your salary. You need to do what I tell you to do. How stupid is that? The person speaking doesn't realize there are 10 other people in the room who totally disagree with what they want to do. They're that stupid. But stupid doesn't make you sin, but sin makes you stupid. And democracy is a part of that. People obey the government, which obeys the people, who obey the government, which obeys the people. I mean, it's circular. There's no foundation. There's no rational foundation for it. Circular authority suffers from the same weakness as circular reasoning. They both lack a foundation. So democracy promotes arrogance because it suggests to some people that they should, to many people, that they should be able to lord it over their neighbors. What is that saying about it's better to live under one tyrant 3,000 miles away than 3,000 tyrants 1 mile away? That is such a great saying. You know, authority, true authority, like water, flows what, uphill? No, true authority flows downhill, not from the people up to the rulers, but from rulers down. Authority flows initially, all authority flows from God. Then through the government, to men, and passes through the parents, even to reach the children. So the Bible says, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. That's a general rule. If the government tells you, here, go kill the innocent, let's go intentionally kill the innocent, then you disobey the governing authorities. Then you disobey, for we must obey God rather than man. You know, there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Now, many Christians read that and they get confused. They think it means that Hitler was appointed by God. That's how confused they get. Or that God has given parents authority over their children, so because they have bad theology, they think a child conceived in rape, somehow that the rapist has authority over the child because they're just confused. God has established the authority flow. He's established the authority system so that he's established the concept that parents have authority over their children. There may be any number of instances where that authority has been abused, and so the parents should not have authority over the children. Or it might be that there are usurpers and tyrants who take authority over their neighbors, and by murder and other crimes end up being a tyrant over a city-state, a nation. And that doesn't mean that God put that person in authority, but it could show that that person has usurped authority that was never his to begin with. So these concepts, they're really straightforward. They're the kinds of ideas that children can understand. But to get to them, you have to start from a biblical foundation. And that's what we'll be doing when we introduce our proposed Constitution for America. This is Bob Inyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278.